You would think a self-described Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist farmer would pretty much describe anybody. But we're talking about Joel Salatin, and it's just the tip of his iceberg. Joel's written many books, including Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. He's been featured in the food film documentaries Food, Inc. and Fresh, the movie. I'm Robin Clare. It is a great world. This is Tributaries. Joel, I'm glad things at Polyface Farm are running smoothly enough for you to get out and share your experiences in the world. Although, you did just mention right now we're speaking to you while you're fixing a fence out in the field. Tell us a bit about a recent trip to Australia. What was the nature of your trip, and were there any surprises?
Sure. The reason I was there was because there's an organization called Regen Ag. What it's trying to do is bridge the gap between the soil food web, holistic management, international, permaculture, and traditional. It's trying to take the ideas of permaculture and yeoman's, you know, water design systems to a, instead of just being a kind of a backyard deal, to a, you know, a broad acre, to scale it up, to really, really touch the food system in a fairly large way. And people ask me, you know, what's so unusual about Polyface? I think the unusual thing about Polyface right now is that we're doing stuff on such a scale, and we're staying true to form. We still, even when we rent, when we lease farms, you know, we're still running egg mobiles behind cows and stacking, you know, broilers and turkeys and all this stuff. I think it's just the trying to actually be a credible, full-time, salaried, scaled operation that is one of our distinctives.
And what did you find down there? Did you find people doing similar things, or was there something you had an aha moment about that you might want to integrate into what you're doing?
Well, not this time. I would say the most fascinating thing for me on this trip was a visit to a Melbourne. This was in the city of Melbourne. It was the old rock quarry that actually built many of the early houses and roads in Melbourne as it was developing in the 1860s and 70s. And dug this huge hole in the ground. And then in the 1920s and 30s, it became the city dump. And so they filled the hole. They quarried the rock out of it, and then they filled it up with junk, debris, rubbish, as they would say in Australia. And then it just sat there for a couple decades as an eyesore until a couple people 30 years ago saw the potential of it, kind of started to reclaim it, and started building gardens and things on it. And today, this outfit, without any government monies, employs 200 people in entrepreneurial, self-employed enterprises. And they got, you know, they got a restaurant, cafe, they've got, you know, entertainment, education. They do a lot of school educational stuff, but it's turned this old quarry, turned landfill, turned now it's in the, you know, one of the most idyllic, beautiful, productive community organizing places in the whole area. So I think for me, as you stand back and look at that, it's just a beautiful example of reclaiming land, of land healing, and it exemplifies perhaps as good as any place I've ever been that just because things are the way they are doesn't mean they're going to be that way forever, either positively or negatively.
Yes.
And so there is a great capacity for the earth to heal. That's a very positive message.
Exactly. Joel, you mentioned something about the Yeoman's water system. What is that?
P.A. Yeoman's was an Australian in the 1940s and 50s who developed what he called the Key Line Plant. And essentially what it is a couple of overriding principles. One is every farmer should strive to eliminate surface runoff, and by building ponds, that every farm should be about, you know, between 6 and 10% surface area of water. And And then the other thing is that that water should be used in a drought. The water is there to be used, not there to be looked at. And so part of our responsibility is to hydrate the landscape, and certainly in an area like Colorado, that's critical. And of course, Colorado has perhaps the worst water policy in the whole country, in that it's illegal to even put a rain barrel under your spout. And what Yeomans showed was the whole secret to irrigation, hydration, and land productivity in a more arid environment is to keep the raindrops as close to where they fall for as long as you possibly can. And as long as you keep raindrops close to where they fall for as long as they possibly can, everything downstream is going to be benefited by it. Our problem is that in the U.S., as well as Australia, both of our countries were settled by the British, who were all about drainage. You know, misty, moisty, one misty, moisty morning when foggy was the weather. There they saw water more as a plumbing problem than a hydration problem. And so that mentality, that paradigm, was brought to both Australia and the U.S., and still today, rather than seeing water retention as a hydration problem, we see water as a plumbing problem. Get it out of there, get it on down the river, where it can benefit somebody downstream, rather than keep it as high as it can be for as long as you possibly can, so that it can maintain springs and base flow to maintain constant water, downstream. I get probably the single biggest piece of information I got on this trip to Australia was that 200 years ago, an agronomist went through and took core samples of soil and ran organic matter, carbon tests in the soil, and it averaged 18% organic matter. And today, it averages less than 1% organic matter. And when you realize that 1 pound of organic matter holds 4 pounds of water, you realize that the ability of that land to retain water has been seriously compromised over just like it has here. Same thing in Colorado, everywhere, through overgrazing and abusive land practices, the water retentive capacity of the organic matter has been pulled out. And here we are.
Yes, a while ago I lived on this little island off the coast of Belize, and there was no electricity past 10 o'clock, and they had rain barrels there for water. That was their only water supply, and the only thing that got people out of dark was to steal water out of each other's rain barrels. They were kind of afraid of the dark, but that would get them out sneaking around in the darkness. It was quite funny to see.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. A while back, your parents actually had a cattle ranch in Venezuela, and then due to political unrest, I've read that they lost that cattle ranch. And was there anything in particular you learned from their experience there which has served you well in your own endeavors?
Well, that certainly colored our entire family's outlook on a lot of things. Not the least of which was the ineptitude of government to solve anything.
Explain it more clearly than that.
Well, that is a pretty defining paradigm, the other thing was that you ultimately a culture, a society, is only as free as its ability to allow people to express their, their visions, their dreams, their fantasies, and to allow them to express them. And of course, that was snuffed out there in a, in the anarchy and political unrest that occurred at that time, where there was no, rule of law. Everything was just by bribe, and we weren't willing to bribe anybody. We had a deed, we had land. And I think in our country, we're seeing the same kind of land ethic erosion as we've become a country of, recreation, and nobody's on the farm anymore. They don't appreciate what it takes to keep the fences up and keep the water going and the barns painted and that sort of thing. And So we have a tremendous amount of, whether it's, you know, environmental or land preservation or land conservation, call it what you will, but we have a tremendous number of groups trying to come in and define what a farmer's supposed, you know, what a farm's supposed to look like, so that what's happened is in a lot of these areas, the green agenda has locked down farms from being able to be productive and profitable farms, you know, where we can't have two houses on a farm. There's this kind of consensus in the radical environmentalist agenda that a farm's not supposed to have anybody on it. You know, it's supposed to be like a wilderness. And yet we know that what makes a farm is a farmer. And so we have a lot of effort to preserve farmland, but very little effort to decide how to preserve a farmer. And I would suggest that that preserving farmers is more important than preserving farmland.
Oh, very good point there, Joel. You produce and sell meats on Polyface and on your farms that you qualify as being beyond organic. Why don't you describe how this is so, and do you see the downfall in the quote-unquote organic certification program simply due to this across-the-board mentality that goes into all regulations?
Yes, well, I do on both counts. I mean, first of all, to answer the first question, beyond organic, the reason that we use that term is we are not certified. We don't participate in any government programs. The reason that we use beyond organic is because organic certification, as currently codified in the law, is an extremely non-comprehensive term. There are a lot of things that it allows, from confinement housing of poultry to feedlots for beef to it doesn't answer the big environmental questions of our day relative to tillage, import export. It has nothing to do with local economies, carbon footprints, that sort of thing. You can grow carrots organically. You can grow them as differently as fertility based on site or off site. You can handle weeds with everything from plastic to hand tillage to propane-powered weed killers to, you know, oil-based herbicides. The point I'm making is that when we say organic, people generally just assume that they know what it means, and there's a tremendous amount of variability from confinement housing of poultry to feedlot beef to confinement dairy. And, in fact, that's why there's just a constant stream of suits against the Organic Standards Board that refuses to enforce or, you know, typically doesn't enforce the standards, just because it, you know, as soon as it becomes government, it becomes political. And not only that, but I think there's an inherent bias or prejudice, I should say, in the system when it is financed by the certifiees. In other words, the way the organic certification program works is it's financed by the farmers who certify, or the businesses who certify themselves. And I think that anything that is a certification agency whose budget is based on bringing certified patrons into the system is prejudiced to compromise, because they want to grow the business, if you will. Grow the agency. Well, if they're going to grow the agency, they need more patrons. They need more patrons. They need to certify more people. They need to certify more people. They need to, compromise the certification standards in order to get more people in. So there's an inherent prejudice to making it easier to become a member. And now we've got 164 or something like that. Non-organic additives now allowed in organic foods. Got all sorts of compromises going on, and I just see it, you know, continuing to spiral downward once the government got in it and it has become political. That's just a critical thing. So we describe ourselves as beyond organic because our animals are out on pasture. We buy local, not organic, and I'm sure we patronize some farmers I know we do, that don't use organic practices. We don't buy genetically modified organisms, but I would rather spend my money on a neighbor who may not be true blue organic, unquote, and keep my money in my community and export my money 1,000 miles away, bathe, quote unquote, organic in diesel fuel to get it to me. These things are not just simple. And so, we want to recognize that by stimulating a conversation rather than saying, oh, we're organic. Well, as soon as you say organic, I call it hardening of the categories. Everybody knows, they quote-unquote know what you mean by organic, but the fact is it is such a non-comprehensive term with huge variables in it that it's not something that you can actually have a good conversation about, and people think they know, but they don't. And so what you have is an elimination of a conversation that ought to occur, to discover more information. The next question is, well, what kind of organic are you? That should be the next, but that conversation never happens because the assumption is, well, I know what organic is, and so end of conversation. But by using terms like salad bar beef and piggerator pork and pastured poultry, beyond organic, this stimulates a conversation to go beyond the stereotypes. I'm certainly not an enemy of organics. I mean, I sat on the very first certifying board in Virginia, and I only lasted 2 sessions when I saw the kind of politics that was involved. A big producer would come in, and everybody would, fawn and worship and bow down, and he got everything he wanted. And some guy that was a little bit of a out-of-the-boxer, really creative, and maybe had raised a couple of issues in some of the meetings, they gave him the, raspberries and didn't certify him. I just saw the politics of it, even in our little group, and realized how jaundiced it was.
Right. I just, as you were talking about your little meeting, I just envisioned a group of kindergartners throwing spitballs.
These weren't kindergartners. These were well-read, sharp folks. But, we were sitting there as an adjudicating panel on who gets in, who gets out. That's another one of our problems with certification is you're either in or you're out. And it doesn't recognize either additional excellence or the effort that somebody's made to get real, real close but not quite get in. It's a pass-fail. And I know that in college, pass-fail courses never bring out the best in you. You just do the minimum, and they push everything toward a minimalist standard because there's no additional reward for the person that does better. And that's another issue that I have with it is that it's just pass-fail, which means that everything is driven to the minimalist standard instead of a maximalist.
That will happen with any regulation, as all inquisitions, whether they're religious or political, mm-hmm. have a pattern. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
And where are we in the pattern of the food inquisition? Do you see us wriggling out of this food freedom inquisition? And thank you, by the way, for leading the pack here.
No, I don't. I see it getting much, much worse. Now, I'm not pessimistic. I'm a quintessential optimist, big picture. But I'm extremely alarmed at what I see right now with farms being raided that are selling raw milk Rawsum Food Co-op in California was just raided with SWAT teams and some machine guns, They're interpreting that if I own, and I know Colorado offers herd shares for raw milk, you can own a
yes,
own a
I'm part of a
herd.
Co-op. Yes.
All right. Well, in California now they've interpreted that you can only drink the milk on the premises where your cow is housed. So if you own a herd share and you go to pick up your milk, the moment you drink it away off the property where your farm is housed. That is the that milk has gone into commerce, and therefore is illegal.
Right. And we're having trouble with the farms being able to turn that product into cheeses or creams
yes.
or butters. And
yes, absolutely. So what we've got is what I call an enslavement of the food system. By the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., and what I call loosely the food police, we have lost freedom of food choice in this country. We have the freedom to own guns, worship, and speak, but what good is that if you don't have the freedom to choose the food to fuel your 3 trillion member internal digestive bacterial community to give you the energy to go shoot, pray, and preach?
Right. I mean,
and it's, it's such a fundamental right that it should be it should be just a given.
Yes.
But the FDA has now put in writing in its answer to briefs filed by the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which I call the NRA of the food freedom front. Like the Homeschool Legal Defense Association 20 years ago was creating judicial wiggle room for parents who were being carted to jail for truancy violations for daring to educate their kids at home. Now we have the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which has sprung up as the helper, the judicial real-time legal counsel for thousands of farmers who are trying to access their neighbors with better food than what's in the supermarket, but the food police are trying to deny you and me the freedom to acquire the food of our choice. And
yes.
The FDA has now gone on record in answering legal briefs by Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund that that American citizens have no fundamental right to choose the food of their choice. That's a in writing. That's a pretty amazing statement.
It is,
and should give us all pause.
Yes, exactly. And the question I have right now that's just burning is whose idea ever was it anyway to put the food and drug in one administration? That's just insanity from the get go.
Well, sure it is, because they view the two as similar. And now we have the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2010 that was signed by President Obama January 4. And for the first time in our history, perhaps any country's history, it uses the phrase science-based 11 times as a regulatory objective term, as if science-based is something that everybody agrees on. What's interesting is who's going to interpret science-based production and processing is none other than Michael Taylor, who was the 10-year Monsanto attorney who shepherded transgenic modification into the world. And so we can only imagine the kind of science that he's going to assume is correct. I mean, it won't be the science of compost piles, it won't be the science of earthworms, and it certainly won't be the science of food freedom. It'll be the science of Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland, artificially produced, highly processed, reconstituted, prostituted, amalgamated, reconstituted stuff.
Right. It's like the farm, PHARM.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
PHARM, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Joel, what's the craziest scientific or chemical or political move you've been privy to in this system here?
Oh, the craziest. Well, I would say one of them would be the Morningland dairy in Missouri, where they've now impounded tens of thousands of dollars worth of cheese over an appearance of, I don't remember what the pathogen is, it's either Campylobacter or something. But the fact is there are lots of strains. There are benign and toxic strains. And so I think in the little picture, the problem is that these pathogens that we all read about have benign and toxic cousins. They are signs of living food. And so as we back up the camera and look at the foodscape from a big picture, what we have now is the official government policy that the only safe food is sterile food. And so it's perfectly safe to feed your kids, Mountain Dew, Twinkies, and Cocoa Puffs, but raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, and Aunt Matilda's pickles are hazardous. And this is a complete abrogation of food as life, and of course that's just a natural permutation beyond chemical agriculture, in which animals and plants are viewed as simply mechanistic, inanimate piles of protoplasmic structure to be manipulated, however cleverly Huber's can imagine to manipulate them. And so what we have here is a paradigm, an assault, if you will, on the very foundation of food, farming, soil as a living substance. Instead, it's viewed as antiseptic, sterile, and inanimate.
Right, the laboratory, the scientific laboratory. Here we go again.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the critical aspects of knowing what is food is, will it rot? Because fundamentally, food that rots, that decomposes, is living. If food doesn't rot or doesn't decompose, it's not a living food. And your body and mine, we're made up of living things. Our bacteria, our 3 trillion intestinal, the 3 trillion beings housed in our intestinal community are not sterile and they're not inanimate. In fact, now we have a university, a professor at Stanford University, who's actually identified their language. They actually talk to each other and learn and adapt and whatever. They actually have a language. And so there's a community of beings down here in our insides that actually talks and is absolutely living. Now, I'm not sure they have, you know, school board meetings and Republicans and Democrats.
But we all hear our stomach, right? They go, oh, your stomach is talking. Now we have a whole new visual on that one.
That's right. But the fact is that this is, when we talk about community, you know, this is probably our most intimate and important community that each of us is a part of. And that community wants food that will decompose, that will rot. It doesn't want food that you can't pronounce. It doesn't want food that you can't prepare in your kitchen, that you need a laboratory to prepare. We're the first civilization in the history of humankind that has foisted upon this community of beings food that you can't make in your kitchen, that you can't pronounce. And that should give us all pause that we have turned ourselves into guinea pigs. And, of course, you know, we're the first culture in the history of humanity that's dealt with the kind of chronic issues, you know, from obesity to type 2 diabetes, to childhood leukemia. Diseases that have plagued humankind up until now have been primarily diseases of sanitation. Now we're moving into an era in which they are diseases that indicate a dietary consumption that is not life-giving, that can't decompose, that can't rot. And I would, just to finish the thought, I would say that it is a profound spiritual and ecological truth that in order for there to be life, there must be death. In order for something to live, something has to die, whether it's through decomposing, whether it's through, you know, mastication in the mouth and subsequent, eating by my internal bacterial community. The cycle of life, of death, life, regeneration, death, life, regeneration, that cycle is powerful. And the fact that you can take most of what's in the supermarket in a package and set it on your kitchen table for a month, or even a year, and it just sits there without molding, without changing, without desiccating, without anything, should give us some pretty serious
food for thought.
Food for thought.
Not for
nice
eating.
Fun.
Joel Salatin, a great American, as is Vernon Hershberger, who was just recently acquitted by a jury in Wisconsin on 3 counts of food crime. He was selling raw dairy to his neighbors. But this basically legalizes raw dairy and direct-to-consumer food clubs in Wisconsin. Bravo. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. On iTunes Podcasting, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.